Hi, and welcome back to the Leading Language and Literature Podcast with me, Chris Jordan. In this episode, I'm speaking with Professor Guy Claxton. Guy is a cognitive scientist, author, and one of education's foremost experts on practical ways of expanding young people's relationship with and capacity for learning. His most recent book, The Future of Teaching and the Myths That Hold It Back, is a work that seeks to reclaim the nuanced middle ground of teaching that develops both rigorous knowledge and character, as well as laying the foundations for a 21st century education. We discuss what good thinking is and why there is a dearth of it in schools, what teachers' departments and schools can do to better attend to students' attitudes and dispositions, what expert amateurism is and how it would challenge the current paradigm, Guy's third way for education or guided discovery, how we go about convincing state schools that academic outcomes aren't everything, and finally, whether Guy would advocate for a move away from traditional subjects and move towards a more responsive curriculum. Thanks again to Guy for giving up in his time in a very busy schedule to talking so broadly, passionately, and practically about the experiences of students and the changes we need to make to respond to a changing world. If you want to be kept up to date on when educational chat like this happens, then be sure to subscribe to the podcast and or follow me on Twitter at ChrisJordanHK.
Okay, guys, so near the beginning of the book, you encourage the reader, the would-be reader, to consider the values and purposes of schooling, one of which that you talk about at that moment and throughout the book, I think, is good thinking alongside the accumulation of knowledge. To you, what is good thinking and why is there a dearth of it in schools around the world?
It sounds like there's two issues in there, Chris. Mm-hmm. So let me deal, if I can, quickly with both of them. Mm. The first is considering the values and purposes of schooling. I think it's very strange that we don't do that more. I think part of my work, as I reflect on it, has been trying to help schools develop a clearer, more precise, more detailed sense of what they consider the desirable outcomes to be. Broadly, what is it that we want our kids to know? What is it that we want them to be able to do? What is it that we want them to be like? What kinds of characteristics, what kind of strengths, attitudes, or what's the IB word? Aptitudes, is it? Or something like that. Learner attributes, right? So those kind of things. And I think you can't really begin to talk about education unless you're clear about where it's heading. It's like, was it John Lennon who said or sang once, "How can I go forward when I don't know which way I'm facing?" And a lot of schools don't know which way they're facing. And in lieu of having that hard conversation with themselves, they just default back into, well, it's all about exams and it's all about getting kids to high status universities, because it's like the rest of it goes into the too hard basket, or it's dealt with in terms of platitudes or things that don't really get a grip on a tight grip on what's going on in school. So broadly, a lot of my work has been around, I use the metaphor a lot, of knitting, of trying to knit together more tightly the sense of what we want. You know, what would we be proud of? What would we be embarrassed by in terms of the kids who leave us? You know, if they became people like the people who are being investigated at the moment by the post office in the UK, having lied and covered up and ruined people's lives and are taking home £250,000 a year, would we count those people as successes of our school or failures? We need to be asking ourselves those questions. And then when we've decided that, we can say, so what does the pedagogy need to look like that will get us there? What do the subjects or the topics need to look like? What forms of assessment will get us there? But a lot of schools are driven by external factors way too much, and are a kind of mishmash of, you know, the path of least resistance and the upcoming inspection regime and the legacy of powerful characters in the school. And you end up with a bit of a kind of dog's dinner of purposes and histories. So a big part of what my work has been is about trying to gain that clarity and that coherence, knitting together the vision and the practice of the school a bit more. So that's the kind of sort of the broad thing. But one of the things you picked out is the nature of good thinking, which seems to me to be, I think everybody's in favor of it, but not everybody knows what it is. And quite a lot of schools kind of naively believe that cultivate that by doing algebra and the periodic table and the history of Hong Kong or whatever, somehow automatically by studying those things, you will become better at thinking. And there is very strong evidence that that is not the case. That people come out of school with good grades, a lot of them, able to do examination thinking, which is pretty narrow, pretty prescriptive, but no better at participating in the democratic process. There are a lot of highly educated people who vote disastrously, and we don't need to name names about that. So I think particularly at the moment with the rise of populism and Trump and Boris Johnson and Putin and goodness knows what's going on in the world, good thinking is really at a premium, and school ought to be the place that builds good thinking. Let me just give one little example. I could talk about this forever. I read an article by a British journalist a little while ago who'd been to visit some schools in Finland. Finland often gets wheeled out as an example of good practice. But this example of good practice is not always the one that people latch onto. He was interested to go and look around because the Finns had instituted a kind of curriculum of fake news detection across the curriculum. And this journalist walked into a, I think, pretty average, ordinary primary school and was slightly startled to get into conversation with a six-year-old who started to explain to him the difference between misinformation, disinformation, and malinformation, and to give examples of the difference, the increasing malevolence of those three things. Now, if they can do it in Swindon, they can do it in Hong Kong, and they can do it in London, and they can do it in wherever you might like. It's a matter of priority. If we think being alert to the world of bullshit and manipulation and lying that surrounds us, if we think that's a good thing, if we would like all our daughters to have their kind of mental antennae twitching when they go online, so they're alert to who is this person I'm talking to? How do I know they are who they say they are? In whose interest is it that I buy this product? That we need not cynicism, but everybody needs a healthy, on the alive, skepticism module in their brain. And if we agree that's a good thing, then it's not hard to think about things that we could do in school to build that critical attitude towards knowledge consumption. Instead of treating the history textbook as if it were the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, you could treat it as an object of critical inquiry. You could set kids the task of analyzing a few pages, get them together in pairs, read pages 56 to 73 in your textbook, and then make an argument about what cultural attitudes on behalf of the textbook writer can be inferred from a critical reading of those pages. Any average group of 12-year-olds could have a go at that question, and it would contribute to a desirable outcome of school, which is not becoming gullible and manipulable in the face of hostile and malicious knowledge claims. So that give you, does that give you a bit of an idea?
That's, yeah, it's a very good idea. I think a lot of it resonated with me in the sense that we've had a kind of a leadership change in my school, and the incoming principal has kind of pointed out that our current, what would you call it, kind of school development plan is about 40 pages long. And you've got, you know, a motto that the school lives by, and you've got a motto that the foundation it belongs to lives by. And it's, I think, I can't remember the exact word you used a moment ago, but it definitely, I think it platitudes is the word that you used. And it definitely, that resonated with me in the sense that no one's going to dispute the idea that we want the best for every child, or that we want students to be international, internationally minded, or we want them to be reflective and blah, but it can fall to, you know, it can fall prey to platitudes, because ultimately no one's coming to knock on the door to make sure that you are following through on those pledges, but someone will definitely deliver the exam papers to the door when, you know, May comes around or June comes around, and it's easy to forget all the other things in place of those. So a lot of that resonate with me.
But that's, you know, I would love to see the IB asking itself hard questions about what behaviors, what practical attitudes that manifested in your action in the world, what awkwardness would they like to see arising from their commitment to international mindedness? What's the cash value? Tell me. And then tell me how I have to tweak my teaching in order to achieve that.
Yeah, I agree. Concur.
There's a lot of fine words around. My particular bete noire is helping all our children fulfill their potential. I don't know if that's in your school rhetoric. It's pretty common.
I think it's to help every student to be the best they can be. I think that is verbatim what one of our values is.
Yeah, so what needs to follow from that is a set of outcomes which would enable any child's parents to ring up the school and say, I don't think you're delivering on that pledge. We need to make those pledges more concrete. Helping every child fulfill their potential. What does that mean? I'm 77 in a couple of weeks' time. Have I fulfilled my potential? I do hope not.
I do. Well, I think, like, moving on to another sort of aspect of your work, which I don't think, I'm pretty sure that the river of learning and teaching as a visual, that's been around longer than the book that I'm referring to, Guy, isn't it? Like the future of education. I'm pretty sure I've seen that before the book came out, but it is certainly included in the book. And it is a wonderful visual. For anyone who hasn't seen it, I will include it in the podcast notes. But it kind of quite brilliantly kind of portrays the idea of, like, the top of the river, that which is easy to see being kind of knowledge, I suppose, factual knowledge, and then kind of just below that, which is somewhat visible, I suppose, if you were looking down into the river from a bridge or the bank, so to speak, skills and disciplinary kind of related skills. But the thing which I think you're stressing the most is, are we paying attention to, are we ensuring that the riverbed, which I think you refer to as dispositions and attitudes, are being tended to by the teachers and the school and the staff? What do you think teachers, departments, or schools, for that matter, can do better to attend to the river's bed or students' attitudes and dispositions?
I think you've described the image, the metaphor, very well, Chris. I designed it for two reasons. One is, it was designed as an accessible visual organizer, in opposition to people who are saying you can't do knowledge and character at the same time. There's some kind of, their image was, is of a kind of tug of war. You know, if you start talking about development of learning dispositions or thinking skills, or there's a huge vocabulary in this area, somehow that must inevitably mean that you're withdrawing your attention from calculus and history and the good old stuff. So the implication of my image of the river is that every teacher all the time, whether they know it or not, is operative at all of those three levels. In other words, you can't not be in the attitude shaping business. You can teach history in a way that also implicitly cultivates credulity, or you can teach history in a way that cultivates criticality. It's that you can teach the same history. You don't have to get rid of the content, but you have to use it. We're going to talk about this metaphor a little bit later, that you can now use your history textbook, so to speak, as an exercise machine for developing skepticism rather than credulity. You can use adding fractions as a way of building inquisitiveness and exploration or collaboration, discussion, or you can use adding fractions as a way of building timidity and a fear of making mistakes. So we're all, you can't, the bad news, the tough news is, from that image, the river image, is that you can't not be in the character-shaping business. The only choice you have is to be involved down at the bottom of the river, knowingly or unknowingly. And lots of teachers have, without really noticing, have been involved in, at least there's a high risk of inculcating attitudes like, for example, passivity, dependence, exam focus, and timidity. Lots of students develop that suite of attitudes. Some students become disaffected, anti-intellectual, aggressive, and critical in a negative way of anything to do with the intellect or the life of the mind. Well, you wouldn't want that, really, would you? You wouldn't want that. Some schools, like, for example, and colleges, like, for example, Eton College and Oxford University, have been in the business of cultivating attitudes of glibness, arrogance, and combativeness. Like, they see intellectual debate as a form of sport, as a form of warfare. And then they get to run countries. You know, people who've had their minds warped, you know, they think they're bright, but they're not. They're just specious in terms of their attitude to knowledge. They don't use thinking in an exploratory way or a collaborative way. They use it in a belligerent way. So we're not interested in that. So you have to kind of wait. We have to kind of help people wake up to what may be going on down at the bottom of the river in their classrooms. Are we unwittingly creating, here comes your, I think and talk in metaphors a lot, as you will have gathered from the book. So it's like some classrooms have a kind of invisible undertow in them, which is dragging young people in the direction of this passivity and compliance, and so that they never ask any questions anymore, except, is this going to be on the exam, miss?
Yeah.
Right? But what we want, once we've sat down and figured it out, what I want is an undertow in the classroom. Same stuff, better exam results, we know that, by helping youngsters week on week and term on term move in the direction of increasing inquisitiveness, adventurousness, independence, reflectiveness, criticalness, creativeness, imaginativeness, and so on. So it's, you know, it's up to us whether we're going to play consciously and deliberately as teachers at the level down at the bottom of the river, or whether by accident or by default, we're going to end up with, like a lot of the movement in the States, particularly, of, excuse the accent, we got to get more poorer kids to college. And you can do it by spoon feeding and pushing and nudging and doing that. And yes, we got more poorer kids to college. And then, oh dear, it turned out that 70% of them dropped out in the first year, because what we forgot to give them was the resilience, the resourcefulness, the imaginativeness, the collaborative skills to flourish when they were in the college atmosphere. Oh dear, we forgot to help the river move in that direction, the current of the river, to pull youngsters in that direction. So out of that has come my work on what I now call the learning power approach, which is dozens and dozens of small, doable, low-risk, smart tweaks that any teacher could begin to accumulate in her teaching practice, which would help that current, that undercurrent, to shift from the bad direction into the good direction.
The most impactful thing about coming across that particular visual and the kind of explanation was, you've said it already a moment ago, Guy, but the idea that whether you like it or not, whether you're conscious of it or not, you are actively involved with those disposition and attitudes. There's nothing you can do about it. And I think once any teacher reads that, I think it's impossible to kind of deceive yourself into thinking that's not the case, because it 100% is. Like, in my particular kind of experience, it wasn't today, but it might have been yesterday, I'm working with a student who I'd never taught them before this year. They're kind of year 10, year 11. And when the topic of poetry came up, it isn't something we've studied this year, but as an English teacher, someone might have asked if it was on the course or something like that. And he's a very, very intelligent student, very outspoken, just said, it's pointless. All poetry's pointless. It's useless. I've never enjoyed doing it. And that's the kind of like outburst that I feel like comes from maybe a blind spot in terms of those attitudes and dispositions. You might have gone through a unit teaching poetry, but have we stopped and done the requisite kind of checks? Often we could talk about checks for understanding, but like checks for, you know, personal feelings, resonance is a big word. Like, we probably, enjoyment, exactly, enjoyment, right? I think,
and engagement.
I think, absolutely. What Stephen Fry kind of criticizes this kind of idea of teaching poetry whenever, you know, he went to school, because he said they were forcefully encouraged to appreciate the poem in a particular way. So you've obviously got to be careful. But I think the word resonate, that's a word that I kind of use with the little year sevens at the moment. And it's, you know, confirmation bias, but even the sort of lower attainment students seem to be able to buy into the fact that not every poem's going to be able to speak to you, but one will, you know, out of the many that we offer them. And I'm yet to find the student who hasn't kind of latched on to one or two that they want to write about. So, I think it's particularly powerful to understand that as a teacher, that whether you like it or not, you're sitting in or you're party to those attitudes and dispositions. And if that's the case, wouldn't you want to mold them or help them travel in a particular direction that is, advantageous to the student, or kind of positive to the student's life opportunities. Yeah.
And then if you were interested, you would become more alert to whether you were being successful or not. You would want to know. You'd want to follow up with them.
Yeah.
A lot of people who love maths or who love English literature or something or other, but have never noticed that the net effect of their attempts within a particularly restrictive examination system, their attempts to convey their love and their interest, their enjoyment in Shakespeare, has exactly the opposite effect. It acts like a lifelong inoculation against ever being interested in Shakespeare again. You know, and they didn't know, and they didn't notice.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I think it is, it's a bit of a wake up. And some people, I would disagree with you, Chris, about whether when you encounter my claim that you can't not be in the character shaping business, I think there's lots of people who could, who are perfectly happy to continue denying that that's relevant or important, that it's any part of their job. I'm afraid so. There are people who just, you know, who will basically say, and this, I'll use the example of maths, but it's not by no means really about, I'm a maths teacher, I'm a good maths teacher, I get bloody good results, and now you're telling me I've got to teach bloody thinking as well? Right? Like, get out of my head. You know, I didn't sign up for that. So,
yeah,
you know,
I think
encouraging whatever we can do to encourage people to see that this is what's going on is helpful, but it's not, I don't think it's going to be a road to Damascus experience for everybody immediately, unfortunately.
In like returning to like the future of education and the myth that hold it back, you refer in the book to David Perkins's suggestion that we aim for something called expert amateurism in schools. What does that mean, and how does it challenge the current paradigm?
First of all, I have to say, full disclosure, that David Perkins is one of my gurus in thinking about education. I think he is one of the most powerful and important, and sad to say, somewhat underappreciated thinkers and writers about education. If you want to see what good thinking, what expert amateurism looks and sounds like, and it is expert, read his book called FutureWise, which is about thinking about what is it that he frames the question this way. I don't know, have you come across that book of his, Chris?
I only know it through your work. I did a lot of research into, because you also list out those different kind of concepts that potentially like schools could formulate the curriculum around, so like aesthetics and the nervous system and things like that. So I'm only aware of it through your book. But I looked him up afterwards, but I didn't go as far as buying FutureWise. No.
Okay. Well, he's great. But if you want to see good amateur thinking in action, I mean, he's a prof at Harvard, so he's by no means an amateur, but he writes, you can feel him thinking, you can feel him honestly, intelligently exploring as he writes. And that's pretty rare. Most people, and I'd include myself, write from a point of view, an attitude, a mindset of persuasion. But Perkins writes from an attitude of exploration, which I think is extraordinary and really honorable. So what he means by expert amateurism is, it's not my favorite phrase, but he opposes that to a sort of scholarly or scholastic view of the curriculum in which embedded, it's not always there, and it's not in all schools, and it's possibly less in IB schools, but certainly what I'm calling at the moment the standard model of education is constructed as if it were a 12-year apprenticeship to becoming a scholar, to becoming an academic, and exams are designed to weed those people out. Selection of schools are designed to weed those people out, as if what we wanted more than anything else in the world is more and more professors. Well, I'm with Ken Robinson on this. We need a few professors, but we need an awful lot more plumbers and car mechanics and hairdressers than we need professors. We need people who can think clearly and critically and intelligently about real life issues. And a lot of Perkins' empirical work, a lot of his experimental work, has been showing that the development of scholarly expertise does not automatically generalize into people's ability to think intelligently about real world issues. One of his most influential papers, empirical papers, is called, it's got a lovely title, Post-Primary Education Has Little Impact on Informal Reasoning. Now put that in your pipe and smoke it. Most people believe otherwise, and they have no evidence for that belief.
Mm.
Perkins and other people have evidence that you can become awfully good at history or mathematics or computer science or whatever it might be, and still not be very good at thinking about politics or, you know, for what we do about fake news or climate change or whatever it may be. You have to teach for transfer. It doesn't automatically happen. The mind isn't built that way. And then the question is, how do we teach for transfer? And there are all kinds of, an earlier book of Dave Perkins called Making Learning Whole has a very good chapter in it about how we teach for transfer, what we need to do differently if we are deliberately wanting the knowledge and the skill that kids are developing to be embedded and stored in their minds in such a way that it is of maximal utility and flexibility for the future.
Mm.
But ordinary, straight down the line, expository, didactic teaching does not achieve that. Most people who are taught maths in a didactic way, a lot of them use maths later on in their life, but they never bother to use the maths they were taught at school. They didn't see the relevance. And that's shocking. That's dreadful. If we're teaching in a way that is designed to produce a small, desirable small number of scholars, and the rest of young people who come out of school feel that to a greater or less extent they're failed scholars. Well, I'd much rather they came out feeling that they were successful plumbers than failed scholars.
Mm. Yeah, I think the amateurism of it, though, so is it kind of, what does that mean, that you can turn your hand to, yes, you can turn your hand, because I'm trying to kind of relate it to myself in like my own, there's been a boom recently, hasn't there, in kind of like, I suppose not recently, but the idea of sort of psychological or kind of sociological popular kind of self-help books and this kind of thing. And there's, you know, things like Oliver Berkman, like 4,000 Weeks, and, you know, self-help books have been around for a long time. But I suppose I listen to a lot of those and I think to myself, and okay, like I'm an English teacher, and I suppose by trade, some of these skills are kind of hardwired into me. But like, I don't really have any background in psychology, and I don't have any background in sociology or these kind of things. And I listen to certain books and it's just, I'm like, that doesn't quite seem to marry with what this one is saying, but I'll go on and listen to. So I'm building a kind of like, you know, a very informal base of understanding or like body of knowledge, so to speak, about this particular thing, which means that, you know, over a year or two, maybe 3 years, once I've listened to enough of these things, I can make quite an informed decision about whether or not, you know, it is a good idea to go part-time in my job because I'll be able to be motivated and blah blah blah. Is this what it means by kind of expert amateurism, the ability or the attitude or the disposition to be able to kind of transfer the kind of approach you've taken to, it could be the kind of like traditional disciplines in school as we know them, but rather than kind of cross every T and dot every I, no pun intended, and know, you know, quite as much of the infinite body of knowledge that's seemingly required in curriculums nowadays, we kind of approach it with a more kind of autonomous kind of approach to it, that students have a better idea of how to manipulate the body of knowledge that they're working with, rather than reach the absolute depths of understanding everything like a scholar would. Is that a fair explanation?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got, if you'll let me, just to read the little bit of the FutureWise book where Dave Perkins tries to explain what he means by that. The expert amateur understands the basics and applies them confidently, correctly, and flexibly. And he gives an example. The expert amateur in statistics and probability, for example, may not know anything about such advanced topics as multiple linear regression or factor analysis. But the expert amateur does have a sharp sense of what means and standard deviations signify, how they can describe a population well or not so well, how small samples can prove deceptive, what kinds of odds and returns make for a good bet or a poor bet, how pie charts and bar charts describe distributions, and so on. Expert amateurism serves very well most of what we do in life outside of our professions. In such areas as child rearing, filling in your tax forms, appreciating art, managing our own healthcare, or pursuing sports, at best, we are expert amateurs, and all too often, not even that. Expert amateurism accomplishes a lot. I think that's quite good. Don't you?
That's comprehensive, yeah. I completely understand that. And it kind of, it goes
and that
back
requires a different form of teaching. That's his whole point.
Agree.
If you're teaching Ohm's law to people who want to be electricians, it's a different experience from if you're teaching it to a group of people who are studying for GCSE physics. It's different.
I do worry about the scholarly movement, so to speak, I suppose you could call it. I mean, in terms of the fact that, like anything, I suppose, that becomes de rigueur in education, I do think there's been like a big lethal mutation. And ironically, some of the kind of big voices of education, which are, I suppose, not particularly aligned to either side of the spectrum, but people like, I've heard conversations with kind of Christine Council and Mary Meyer on podcasts, and for years, not just those two kind of professionals, but plenty of others as well, have been saying like less in more detail, less in more detail, less in more detail. And like one of your great contemporaries who wrote the foreword for the book, Dylan William, I've heard him say on numerous occasions, it is impossible to cover everything that could be or would be in the curriculum. So that's an unattainable target.
Yes.
So therefore, maybe we need to kind of circle the wagons back around, so to speak, and ask ourselves, you know, what's our best bet for the knowledge that should be covered, but also what goes along with it? Because we might be able to buy ourselves a bit more time here. And that, I suppose, that David Perkins thing speaks to that very, very, very clearly, very starkly.
Absolutely. So, I mean, we would all agree that, you know, what people like to call the knowledge-rich curriculum, but which is, in fact, the knowledge-stuffed curriculum, leaves out a whole other area of desirable outcomes of education, which is good thinking and good learning. Becoming resilient, becoming resourceful, becoming critical, becoming creative. These are skills. Thinking, your mind is a constellation of skills and attitudes and aptitudes that are built out of your experience. We know that now. Intelligence isn't some fixed pot of IQ something or other that you know, that you're just born with and that's that. So our job should be to understand this process, these process outcomes. What does it mean to be a good thinker? What does it mean to be a critical consumer of knowledge? And then, you know, when less is more, that doesn't mean less content that we dig into it in a scholarly way more deeply. It means less content, and we focus on, and what are we learning by doing this, by studying this? What are the valuable residues in people's minds that will help them function in managing their healthcare, child rearing, filling in their tax forms, appreciating art, pursuing sports, the examples that David Perkins uses. Yeah. That's the bottom line for me, you know, because it's scandalous that education still in many places, many jurisdictions, is designed at very broad terms to produce about a third or a half of people who consider themselves to be relative successes after 12 long years, and two-thirds, a very large proportion of people who come out of school saying, well, what was that all about?
Mm.
Or may come out even worse, feeling that, you know, one of the most important things they've learned is that they're crap at learning or thinking, you know? So it's like, first of all, and my philosophy is very simple. First of all, get clearer about what would be a good education, especially for the people who are not going to be scholarly successes of the examination system. What about them? What are they going to take away from school that they value, that they say, thank you, that was great, a great education. I got two lousy GCSEs, but you gave me a great education. Everybody ought to be able to say that, and school principals should be losing sleep at night if they don't have a good answer to that question.
Yeah, that's fair. With that in mind, then I suppose that's very much kind of David Perkins's kind of conceptualization. But you, in the book, you do kind of refer to the idea of a third way. That idea of a third way stuck with me for quite a long time, because when I was doing my teacher training, I think constructivism as a philosophy was very big in the UK. So we're talking like 2007, 2008, that kind of thing. And then I went abroad, and it often in international schools, particularly in schools that are affiliated with the UK, you'll find teachers who are kind of set in amber in terms of, not in a pejorative sense, but like whatever they learnt when they were training tends to be quite hard fought to change, like, because international education doesn't fall prey or victim to the machinations of like a government system quite as much. Which means that they'll usually stay within the stasis of which they did their training or when they last left the UK, so to speak. So a lot of those teachers were also well versed in kind of constructivist ideas. But then there was that great shift in the UK, America, Australia maybe as well, and it was, you know, quite a popular idea, this kind of direct instruction and knowledge rich curriculum, and this big discussion happened essentially. And I saw the weaknesses with constructivism, and I saw the strengths of direct instruction, and I definitely, you know, lurched quite strongly towards direct instruction. But it, as I've heard with quite a few sort of people online or podcasters or bloggers and this kind of thing, it leaves something to be desired. There's something missing, so to speak, that definitely constructivism wasn't quite providing, and direct instruction doesn't either. And so this idea of a third way is quite a funny, I don't know, again, I've used the word a few times today, but it resonated quite strongly with me in terms of this idea of being in the middle. And you refer to it as guided discovery. Over the course of a year, let's say, in a teacher's classroom, what would you envisage or envision for guided discovery, Guy? Like, what would it look like from the beginning of an academic year to the end of an academic year?
I want to spiral around to that specific thing at the end and say a couple of things first.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding, I mean, I'm a retired professor of the learning sciences. I have a PhD in experimental psychology. So I've earned my spurs when it comes to thinking about the nature of learning. And I think to treat constructivism, to treat the idea that kids are in the business of making sense of what they hear and read, not just absorbing or internalizing. That feels to me like that's fact. Like, we know that that's true. Read recent books by Stash Dehane called The Basis of Learning. Read Alison Gopnik's book, The Carpenter and the Gardener. There is masses of research which shows that that's the way we're wired. We're wired to pay attention to things that we find curious, surprising, or disappointing. That our learning is driven by the desire to make sense of things, and we are particularly alert for things that don't seem to make sense, but somehow we want them to, or they ought to. So the idea that constructivism is an ideology seems to me to be parallel to supposing that the theory of evolution is an ideology, which is what some of the creationists say. They say, it's just another way of looking at it. No, it's a very much better way of looking at it, which is supported by all kinds of data and all kinds of argument. So the element of constructivism is not, I don't think it's an option. It's not a choice about how to teach. It's a fact about the nature of learning. Start with that. Secondly, I think this middle ground that I talk about, this is one simple way, I'm not sure if I put this in the Future of Teaching book, but I think, I mean, really, really, really simplistically, teachers do two things in the classroom. There are two things going on. There's explanation. Teacher is explaining things. Books are being read, which explain things to you. So there's explanation. And then there's exploration, which is finding things out for yourself. So one is having been told about the way things are, being given models and information and theories and notions and frameworks for thinking. And the other is finding things out, exploring, discovering. Now, my reading of the research literature is, if all you're interested in is your students' performance on high-stakes testing, then put explanation front and center. It works. It is a good way of aiming for that. But if you're interested, as all schools are, they always say something about this, even if it's pretty bland on their website. No school ever says, send us your kids and we'll squeeze the best possible grades out of them, do nothing else. There's always some kind of plus on there. But if you're interested in that, and you know, there's not much dissent about that. Curiosity, problem solving, collaboration, entrepreneurship, critical literacy. It's like there's a cluster of things that are pretty broadly accepted. If you're interested in the cultivation of those, then you have to involve exploration. Exploration is the way in which, to use my language, my metaphors, you stretch and strengthen and make more skillful those mental muscles, which you'll take away with you from school. So we're back to the question of what are our values? There is no such thing as best teaching or best practice. There's only best practice for certain outcomes. Going back to your very first question, Chris, it's like, what are we teaching for? So if you're only teaching for grades, by all means, go for, I don't like to use the phrase direct instruction because it's a technical term.
Yeah.
For Rosen, what's his name? Rosen. Rosenshine. I've got ticked off by people for saying that. It's like, well, he doesn't say exactly that. So direct instruction with a small d, the small I. But I call, people talk about explicit teaching or didactic teaching or something like that. Teaching that says giving kids time and opportunity to struggle, to grapple, to explore, to discuss is a waste of time. It's much more efficient and effective if we just tell them, which is a very common ideology. That's fine for the exam scores, but just be aware of the fact that a whole raft of learning down at the bottom of the river is being driven in the wrong direction if that's your pedagogy. That's your day in, day out pedagogy. So what does it look like? I think over a year, I'm just reading some work by, it's very interesting, people who talk about the learning sciences as if it justified, like Paul Kirchner and others, as if it justified direct instruction, didactic teaching. Go read books by another professor. In fact, the person who coined the phrase the learning sciences, who was the founder of the Society of Cognitive Science, who instituted the first Institute of the Learning Sciences at a high-status university in the USA, a man called Roger Schenck. And I'll show you, the listeners will be able to see this. This is his book that I'm reading at the moment. He is as close as you can get to an authority on the learning sciences. And his a lot of his work is revolved around, and he, very interesting, using online, you know, not multiple online courses, but carefully designed project work that escalates in complexity in a whole variety of different dimensions over the course of time. So it's not unguided, it's not sloppy, it's carefully designed with more than half an eye on what are the mental muscles that we want kids to be building through engaging with this complex issue in small groups over a period of a year. And if you read his book, this is his Education Outrage, is more of a polemical book, but his more thoughtful book is called, which I'm in the middle of reading at the moment, is called Teaching Minds. And in that, he describes, Schenck describes exactly what you're asking me, like what a year would look like. And it's basically, as I've said, it's carefully crafted, well-designed sequence of projects that gradually become more complex and more demanding. There are high levels of knowledge, high levels of rigor, high levels of disciplinary thinking, but they are all emergent from students being hooked by a problem or an issue that they find relevant, meaningful, engaging, and challenging in terms of their own lives. The caricature of discovery learning that is peddled by some of the direct instruction people, even people who claim who ought to know better, who are themselves professors of cognitive psychology or something like that. It's like cognitive psychologists. I've just blogged about this recently and got myself into a lot of trouble. The learning sciences is a constellation of broad, divergent approaches to the nature of learning and how we can foster it. There isn't one agreed thing, which is, you know, a simplistic model of long-term memory and short-term memory that was devised by Baddeley and Hitch in 1974. And nothing of any interest has happened since. You know, that is just kind of form of intellectual vandalism to present that as if it were the be-all and the end-all of cognitive science or the learning science.
I think, like, yeah, the analogy comes to mind that is used in the foreword to your book. The idea, I think, is Dylan William who says, the idea of like the drunk person looking for their keys under the light at night time, not because that's where they are, but that's where the light is. It's like,
yes,
it's easy to kind of, you know, go looking for something if you're only willing to kind of notice or pay attention to one particular aspect of it. I would say though, I mean, in terms of the constructivism aspect of teaching, like what you just said, what you just mentioned there, Guy, about like a really carefully sequenced approach to whether it's project-based learning or inquiry-based learning or what have you, and there is a distinction. I think that's the thing that was sorely lacking for me when I set out in my career. I think that it's like you're given certain kind of ideas. I don't think they're any more than ideas, where it's like, have them do group work. And it's, you're attending to, you know, in some cases, 30 students in the class, five of which might be incredibly high attainment, five of which might be, you know, really kind of low attainment. And it's, you know, factoring all these, what do I do when this pair is done after 10 seconds and these two still don't know what I'm talking? And I think that's where the temptation, where I think there was quite fertile breeding ground for this direct instruction thing to arrive, that was like, listen, if you take these steps, they will be able to do, mechanically is quite a pejorative term, but they will be able to recreate what you're showing them to do with relative ease. I think that was a very attractive proposition for young teachers, frustrated teachers, young leaders, frustrated leaders. But hopefully we are coming to a point where, yeah, the whole idea of like hot housing for an exam is great in and of itself with regard to the certificate you get at the end, and maybe you can go to a university or get a good job. But yeah, there's got to be more to it than that, I think, realistically. Yeah. So I'll certainly look up the writer that you're talking about and the book that you're talking about. I'll link to it in the show notes
Roger Shang, and his the better of the two. Well, they're both really good read, but the better one is called Teaching Minds, which is very, very good. If I can just respond to what you were saying, I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying, Chris. Of course there is. And, you know, we've been over the last 30 or 40 years, or maybe much longer than that, we've been on a journey of discovery about the sophistication of pedagogy and the varieties of pedagogy. You know, it's like most good teachers that I know are somewhere in the middle. They do some explanation, some framing, some knowledge giving, but that's woven in, and they manage it in a dynamic way. So there's some exploration, there's some explanation. So that's like what we're calling the third way, is just everything that good teachers do, which is not either the extreme of ridiculously laissez-faire discovery, where the kid's just milling around not knowing what they're supposed to be doing on the one hand, and really prescriptive, didactic, sit and still and listen and copy it down and, you know, regurgitate it stuff on the other. All the interesting stuff happens in the 95% of the territory that is neither those two extremes. And I think, I don't know if this is fair or unfair, I know that there are some examples, like, we're not going to speak ill of the dead, but like Chris Woodhead, who was a director, as you will know, in the UK, of Ofsted, of the quality control mechanism, who became very anti-progressivism. And in his early years as a young teacher, was very progressive and had a very progressive idea, subscribed to the kinds of things that I would subscribe to. But he found that it didn't work with kids in a school, a fairly kind of rough, low, what they call in New Zealand, a low decile school, high proportion of kids on pupil premium, free school meals, in a rather impoverished suburb of Bristol. And I think there are other people who've become very hostile to progressive education who had similar experiences.
Yeah.
That they went into a class wanting to be more friendly, more relaxed, more open, and it didn't work. And at that point, they had a choice, I think. One choice was to say, this progressive stuff is harder than I thought it was going to be. It's more sophisticated. It's more nuanced. Maybe I misjudged what this group of kids were ready for. Maybe I went too far too quickly, and it unsettled them. So they messed about. They couldn't cope with it. We hadn't built up to it. That's one road. That's the road less traveled. Because it's like, this is going to be hard work for me to develop a more complex, dynamic, flexible, nuanced set of teaching skills, which will enable me to build towards these characteristics that I want kids to have. And instead, they took the road more traveled, which is it doesn't work and it's a load of crap. Right. And then they spent the rest of their lives vehemently preaching that naive gospel to the world at large. And I think, you know, they've done education a disservice because, you know, understandably, like we all do, the first time you try something, it didn't work very, it doesn't work very well. And then what do? You get some advice, you have another go, you pick yourself up if you think it's worth doing, and gradually you get better at it. And again, a lot of what my work, the practical side of my work has been, what are the little things that any teacher could do? It's like, you know, when I explain these things in a workshop to teachers, my ideal response is the teacher in a workshop in New Zealand, who almost everything I said, she started scribbling it down in her notebook and would look very excited and couldn't restrain herself from saying out loud, "Oh, cool." And I knew what she meant. She meant, I see it, I get it, I like it, and I could do it with my kids. Right? So what we need is to provide teachers with a whole lot of little stepping stones. To take kids from where they are. You freak kids out, kids who are used to being disciplined. If you suddenly, you know, turn them loose and take all the structures off and say, well, what would you like to learn? Of course, they're going to be freaked out, or they're not going to trust you. They're not going to believe you. It's a complicated thing. So, you know, I think we're still in recovery, as you said quite rightly, from some early and rather naive ways of trying to be, quote unquote, progressive.
And that could, this kind of returns us then to like the IB, which is in microcosm, kind of maybe, I don't know if it's too harsh to say, that kind of naivety is lying dormant in some of the kind of program materials that gets, you know, distributed to schools when they sign up to be an IB World School. Because I think the third way that you refer to is actually aligns quite significantly with what we do in the middle years program in the IB, certainly in English. I would think every subject, actually, and to a lesser extent, the diploma program. But, and I've seen this work very well in an international setting. I've pushed kids to the point of, like, you know, in terms of direct instruction, like a number of years ago now, I remember kind of going through the looking glass, so to speak, and just thinking, at this point, they're memorizing things that they have no conceptual appreciation of. This is basically like an Ebbinghaus experiment where they're just memorizing nonsense syllables that they're not going to be able to blah blah blah. So I kind of came back from the precipice, and it is possible to kind of balance these two things in terms of dispositions and reflection and personal preference, but also kind of working out where our biases lie and where, you know, all this good stuff, as well as knowledge, as well as skills and knowledge.
It's not either or.
No, it's not either or. But what I am mindful of is the fact that these students are from a privileged, not incredibly privileged, but relatively privileged socioeconomic background. And it feels like for systemic change, the challenge is, like, how do you go about convincing state schools in any country who deal with, as you say, greater economic and educational deprivation, that academic outcomes aren't everything? How I mean, you've given quite a few kind of examples today of how these platitudes exist in schools, and they obviously care about them. But I mean, do you think it's possible for kind of school leaders to ever see past the rankings and the league? The league standings and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, as I say, everybody signs up in theory to the idea that education should be about more than grades and tests and certificates. I haven't met anybody who doesn't find some kind of way of talking about what I call the plus, results plus, as our ambition for schools. But I've forgotten where I was going with that. What was I on about?
You were saying like you haven't come across a school where that kind of the values and purposes aren't
It's a sort of, I mean, this has been my work since I published a little book, very successful little book called Building Learning Power in 2002. So it's 23 years old, that book now, which is precisely saying, so what does it take for an individual teacher and a school leader as a whole to move in that? It's like what I just call the little stepping stones, to move in the direction. For a school leader, we've just recently produced a series of four books around the learning power approach. The fourth one of which is a book written by school leaders for school leaders, called Powering Up Your School, for how over a period of about 3 or 4 years you can change the culture of the school from a results only culture to a results plus culture.
Ooh.
And one of the things I always think of, my wife and I met in Greece, and we're great fans of Greece, and particularly fans of a Greek dessert called baklava, which you may have come across. It's a very sweet, crunchy, layers and layers of phyllo pastry. And what a school leader needs to be thinking about is all the different layers that they need to tackle if this culture change is going to take root. And one of them is parental expectations. That you have to work on, particularly in independent schools or international schools, English-speaking, American-speaking, international schools, IB schools. You have to nibble away at the parents' naive view that what they're paying good money for is to get their kids to a high-status university. And there's lots of little things, little snippets of information, things that you could just email around or put on the portal for them to read that will gradually shape their view, broaden their view to understand the importance of what's going on down at the bottom of the river. So just give them, you know, share with parents that my river image, and see if that makes sense to them. Talk to people who work in business. They know that people's attitudes are critical. It's not just their knowledge and their skills. It's their work ethic. It's their self-discipline. It's their ability to get on with other people, to be a good collaborator. Everybody in the real world knows that. It's only in school where somehow or other the value of these things have got forgotten. So nibbling away at those parental expectations, like, for example, I've just given you, you know, you could talk to parents about, you know, in your line of work as a parent, how would you rate the importance of these personal qualities or character strengths? Give them a list. Say, you know, here's your quiz of the week. Pick out or get them to do a Diamond 9 exercise. Give them 9 of them and say, you've done the Diamond 9 exercise? Shape them into a diamond. So which will be the most important in your line of work? Okay, that's great. So half an hour, you can have fun doing that with your husband and your kids or something or other. Now I want you to redo it within terms of what do you think are the most important for children growing up in the mid-21st century? What would you like them to get from their schooling? I've never done that exercise. It's only just occurred to me, but I think it would be quite interesting. Try and foster that conversation, not in a imperious way, but in a we all want the best for these kids. What does that mean? And very quickly, they'll go, you know, there'll be people in Hong Kong who work for some of the big accountancy firms like PwC or EY or Deloitte, who a lot of those big firms are no longer hiring on the basis of, you know, university entrance or university grades. They're hiring on the basis of flexible and fluid intelligence or resilience or what have you. So if the world is changing, if the high stakes, hard nosed world of business is changing, wake up school.
Mm. Yeah, agree. I think the days of kind of getting the best results possible and then getting an entry level job at a big company like that are becoming more and more a thing of the past. I can think of students who, before they even graduated the IBDP, they'd started their own business during COVID, a lot of them work in charities and things like that, but just taking initiative and doing things which, even if they kind of joined a venture and it kind of went bust after 6, 7, 8 weeks, that's legitimate life experience that they can speak to in an interview rather than say, well, I've got this A star or this level 7 because I worked really hard in my mum's spare room. It's not quite, you know, I'm not devaluing that as a particular aptitude or disposition as well as the knowledge set that comes with it. But it seems more fleeting to me than someone who's willing to kind of get out there and set up their own business and take risks and make themselves potentially look silly. And that seems a lot more kind of worthwhile to an employer, certainly. But I think the last question I had for you, Guy, is that you referenced quite a few kind of thinkers, philosophers, writers, academics, whatever, in the book. I think Algebel's in there, Martin Illingworth, Perkins, we've already talked about. But what in like does this hint at a sort of move away from traditional subjects and move towards a more responsive curriculum? Like if you had it your way, is it a fair characterization for a particular, national curriculum or international curriculum, what have you? What would you like to see taught in schools in terms of the way that we approach the core or the curriculum or whatever you want to call it? Would you keep the current paradigm or would you change it in some way?
I think there are lots of things that I would want to change. But one of the things I wouldn't want to change is the concern with knowledge and the concern with accurate and useful knowledge. But I come back to the earlier part of our conversation, which is about, you know, let's say, I mean, here's an exercise you could do in a staff room, professional development. You know, out of every 100 people, let's say 30-year-olds, in terms of your ideal society, how many of those would be professors of academic subjects? How many would be plumbers? How many would be hairdressers?
Nurses.
How many would be stay-at-home mums? How many would be da-da-da-da-da? So it's like, it's the scholarliness. It's the presumption that escalation of the scholarliness of the curriculum, that we want to move in the direction of things that are difficult and abstract, which is sort of a hangover from Platonism, isn't it? The kind of, you know, the true knowledge is abstract. The eternal verities of the world are the things that the educated person ought to need to know. And I think it's a questioning of that. And saying, yes, there's a place for that. You know, I would want maybe five out of my 100 people to be really high expert intellectuals. Maybe 10.
Mm.
Certainly not 50 of them. You know? So that's a skill set. Well, this is another part of my thinking. That scholarship is not really anything to do with being intelligent. It's a skill set. Writing, you know, I'm just in the process of writing my 38th book, and I'm a student of writing. I'm continually grappling with the issues of writing. It's one of the most complicated crafts, at least as complicated as welding or being a secondary school teacher or what have you. It's right. I just went to a lovely little exhibition in Oxford. I had some time on my hands in Oxford the other day. There was an exhibition at the Bodleian Library the exhibition is called Cut, Rewrite, Cut. And it's an assembly of a lot of the books that they have in this incredibly ancient library of the revision, of the hard work that goes into revising, into the making of scholarship, rather than the presumption that scholarship is a reflection of intelligence. It's a craft. And they, like, really interesting, like 14th century illuminated manuscripts of the Bible being copied laboriously by monks and then scrubbing them out, writing, having another go. I've always loved the notion of the palimpsest, like the kind of the scroll that has been erased and written over, that there's a sort of faint shadow of your first draft lingers behind, what have you. It's like, and we ought to, you know, one of the things we ought to be doing is, first of all, treating scholarship as if it were an honorable profession that a minority of youngsters will be cut out for pursuing, and that there are other equally honorable and possibly even more useful in professions which we should be paying equal attention to as we educate youngsters. And it's, so it's not so much, it is partly about changing the knowledge, but go back to my throwaway remark about Ohm's law. It's more about changing the way we engage with that ideal of the expert amateur. Requires a different form of pedagogy. It requires, and Roger Shank is good about this as well, it requires us to keep focusing and remembering that more important than a head full of knowledge is a head full of powerful thinking and learning processes and strategy, which are not predetermined by your genes. And that's our gift. That's the package, the send-off that we want to send out of kids out of our schools, bundled like a new, what do you call it, operating system, right? Bundled with a powerful set of programs for coping with fake news, for coming up with fresh ideas, for repairing relationships, for being a good collaborator, a good sounding board with other people. It's like, it's not hard to be creating a parallel curriculum of those kind of life-worthy, that's David Perkins' word, life-worthy skills and attitudes alongside life-worthy knowledge. A lot of his book, Future-Wise, revolves around this idea of what is life-worthy knowledge? You know, and is it, you know, I would like to see, he doesn't say this, but I would like to see algebra, and in English schools, the Tudors, and in the sciences, the periodic table, have to fight hard for their place in the curriculum against neuroscience and theory of evolution and probability and statistics and a whole lot of other things, which to a fresh mind, an open mind, would seem to be much more useful, much more pertinent to navigate your way through the turbulent waters of the 21st century than the Tudors and the transition metals.
Yeah, very eloquently put, I think, Guy, as always. I find it very hard to kind of disagree with any of that, really. And like, I am kind of sitting in a position that makes it easier to do so. Obviously, being in an IB school, it is part of the kind of the literature and the common language and things like that. But I can't help but feel, I think a conversation I had with someone a while ago, basically, we debating the need to teach students about like iambic pentameter. And my side of the argument was not that it isn't worth learning that particular kind of knowledge. It's just in terms of opportunity cost, like it symbolizes something for me, iambic pentameter, in terms of if we're going to teach that, then you've obviously kind of, what's the what's the kind of equivalent in any of the literature texts, or if we're looking at rhetoric, or if we're looking at creative writing, like, do I need, how far do we take it? And I think it's a really, really useful conversation to have. And I think that's probably the thing which isn't happening enough. Like, those conversations are being shut down in favor of course, they need to know it. You know, school is a scholarly pursuit, and to deprive them of that knowledge is to deprive them, you know, their rights and that kind of thing. But that, yeah, I think to shut down that particular conversation about, you know, knowledge sometimes is, you've got to take the opportunity cost of, if you pursue a certain kind of amount of knowledge in the curriculum or in school time, then you are kind of sacrificing, as we've said before, dispositions, attitudes, aptitudes, and things like that. And I think
it's a whole lot of life worthy knowledge.
Yeah.
That any fair minded point of view has a strong claim to be in the curriculum, and the opportunity cost is quite right. So what's going to go?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is the value, the life worthiness of knowing about iambic pentameters and the difference between a metaphor and a simile and all of that, is that really so empowering for 95% of young people growing up in the 21st century that it can maintain its foothold in the curriculum against all comers? All competing claims. And I think we ought to be having, as a society, as a planet, we should be having, where is the conversation? Where is the vigorous conversation about algebra? Who needs algebra? The claim that algebra is a training for the mind
is
not substantiated. There is no evidence base that studying algebra makes you any more real life smart than anybody else. So what is its claim? What is its justification for a hallowed place in the curriculum? And so on and so on and so on. We should be having a grown up conversation about this, not simplistic punch and Judy stuff about, is it knowledge or is it skills? But what knowledge? What skills? How do we do them together? What personal attributes are malleable enough and important enough for us to be putting them front and center of our desirable outcomes of education? Any grown-up society would be deep in a public debate about those issues. What we have, I'm afraid to say, for reform, educational reform, even things that some of my friends are involved in, when you really stand back, imagine yourself being a kind of anthropologist from Mars looking at schools and thinking, this is a very odd idea.
Yeah.
So, you know, I imagine myself being this Martian anthropologist who someone has just been just, but like E.T., I think E.T. said in the film, it's very, how do you explain school to a higher form of intelligence? And that was a kind of wonderful little throwaway line. A friend of mine had that tattooed on her, emblazoned on her pencil case. That's when she went throughout school. But just, you know, having those conversations and making sure that they're front and center, framing them as really tough questions.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
That we as a responsible society, rather than just bickering, as I say, the Punch and Judy show about, is it knowledge or skills? Is it this or that? This is kind of, for goodness sake, we can do better, can't we, than that black and white Punch and Judy, right, wrong way of thinking and talking about things. That's what the future of teaching and the myths that hold it back. It wasn't so much an attempt to push back. It was partly an attempt to push back against the knowledge-rich / didactic teaching thing, as if it were the only right way, as if it was somehow mandated by cognitive science that that was the only right way to teach. We need to push back against that. But if there was an attempt to try and say, come on, guys and gals, this is complicated stuff. We could do, we ought to be able to do better than this. We ought to be able to be better thinkers about the nature of education these days. And I don't think we're doing very well. I think our report card is not looking very good as a society, particularly in England, where I live. England, to my mind, is one of the most backward educational countries in the planet, in that the attempt to grapple with these questions is not very prominent, not even as it is in some other countries. So we need people jumping up and down and being irritating to try and create this debate a bit more, I think, because kids' lives are being sacrificed to it.
Yeah, but I do think it's difficult. I think you referred earlier to putting it in the too hard box or too difficult box, and it is something which is iterative and it's unwieldy and it's hard and it can get kind of lost at the wayside if a new initiative comes in or a bad Ofsted report gets given or what have you. I think it's something that takes real expertise in terms of balancing all these kind of different things which we owe to the kids. But I'd like to finish, Guy, by thanking you very much for obviously, you know, continuing to add to this discussion, this conversation, as we've called it, throughout the 38 books I think that you mentioned there, but certainly kind of all your work online and your kind of consultancy and that kind of thing is fantastic, but also for giving up your free time to speak to me today. It's been really, really invigorating conversation, so thank you very much.
Not at all. It's been my pleasure, Chris. I hope we'll meet again somewhere.